you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to spend a few minutes with you, all of you tonight. I'd like to thank the Polk County Democrats for inviting us to be here with you. I'd also like to express my appreciation to the UAW for hosting this event. I think it can safely be said that I was the only person ever elected to statewide office in Virginia with a union card, two purple hearts, and three tattoos, one of which I don't want to talk about. And the only one in a statewide campaign ever to walk a picket line during a strike. Very proud of the support that we have for organized labor. It's a big part of who I am. Also, I'd like to say that these videos were so extraordinarily well done, and the one that really got to me, I got to say, was the first one about the veterans. I don't think that anyone who has had to watch friends be shipped away like that will ever forget it. I come from a family with a long military tradition. My dad was World War II bomber pilot, flew in the Berlin Airlift, was a pioneer in the missile program. I was a Marine, my brother was a Marine, my son was a Marine. And I would like to take this opportunity, if I may, to ask those people who are veterans to stand up and be recognized tonight. We're happy to be here in Iowa. I got here yesterday. My bags got here today. And I have to admit, last night, I'm strong in my faith. I'm not apologetic for that. But I did suffer committing a sin of envy. You know, I was sitting in a hotel room there. I'd come from American Airlines from Chicago. We were on the tarmac for 6 hours in a delay. I got to Omaha. And my bag wasn't in Omaha, and I was trying to explain to the baggage people that I was driving to Des Moines. I had to figure out a way to get my bag there whenever it did come in. I got here, my bag wasn't here, and I called my wife, and I started talking to her about this, and I said, look, I get here, I don't know where my bag is, and I look over, and Donald Trump's aircraft is out here on the runway. You know, what did I do? You know, what did I do in my life that I'm stuck on American Airlines, and he's got a plane coming in here? And she said, you know, get over it. You know, you were in such a hurry to get out of here, you didn't kiss me goodbye. This is God's way of getting you a big kick in the seat. I had a great moment over in Council Bluffs yesterday. I spent my high school years in Omaha. I fought Golden Gloves there. I fought Junior Gloves, Golden Gloves, and some military boxing. And one of my great heroes of my life is probably the most underestimated amateur fighter in American history. His name is Harley Cooper. He was my coach my senior year in high school. But more than that, he was a National Golden Gloves champion that year. He had knockouts all the way to the national semifinals, had a decision, had a knockout in the finals. He made the Olympic team the next year, and he was an incredible mentor to me. When I was a kid, I was a 16-year-old kid, moving around in the military. I'd gone to 9 schools in 5 years at one point, and I needed some stability in my life. And I had to work all through high school. That's why I started boxing, because I could do it after work. And in my senior year, I got an academic scholarship. Went to the University of Southern California for a year before I went to the Naval Academy. And so I decided, you know, all these people that got these high school letters, I want to go out for a high school sport, and I want to get myself a letter. So I went out for track, and I ran the 880. And the first meet I was in, I came in second, and a number of schools were in there. I was very proud of myself. I went by to see Harley, who had just won the National Golden Glove. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I got this ROTC scholarship, so I went out for track, and I ran in this race, and I came in second. He looked at me, and he said, wait a minute, are you bragging to me? I said, yeah, I'm proud of myself. I've never done this before. All these people are good athletes. I came in second. He said, don't ever come and talk to me if you come in second. And I said, oh, come on, Harley. Not everybody can be, you know, the National Golden Gloves champion. I'm proud of myself. He said, who ran the first 4-minute mile? I said, Roger Bannister. He said, who came in second? I have never forgotten that in my entire life. And it was terrific to see him yesterday. He's 81 years old. He was on his way to the gym after we had our meeting. We are happy to be here in Iowa. We're going to be back in Iowa. I'm committing to you right now. We're going to go over the whole state here. We're going to be back as many times as we can get here. And we have Rania Batrice, working here full-time. Rania, where are you? In the back, and so you will be seeing more of us. I'd like to take just a few minutes tonight and talk to you about three things that I care deeply about. First, what really are the challenges that are facing us as a nation? Not in great detail, we don't have the time for that, but where do I see the need for us to really focus in the next several years? The first is restoring fairness, economic fairness, social justice into our system. I was talking about this when I ran for the Senate. It was the principal issue that I was talking about when I ran for the Senate. We have had an economic recovery since the Great Recession that's only helped a partial element in our society. We have to be honest about that, particularly as Democrats, we have to be honest about that. If you go to April 2009, when the recession tanked down, and look at the recovery, if you own stocks, if you've got capital assets, you're probably doing pretty well. The stock market bottomed out at a little over 6,000. As recently as a couple of weeks ago, it's been up to 18,000. We've seen the stock market almost triple since April of 2009. Working people's wages have gone down since 2009. Assets, there was a piece today in the national media about the assets of working people have actually decreased. We have to fix this problem. We have to put our leadership efforts into fixing this challenge. We have to reshape our national security posture. I'm proud that I was able to serve as a Marine during a very tough time in our country's history. I also was able to spend 5 years in the Pentagon, one as a Marine, four as a defense executive. I sat on the Armed Services Committee, the Foreign Relations Committee when I was in the Senate, and I've been privileged to be a journalist in the time that I've not been in public service. I was in Beirut when the Marines were in Beirut in 1983, covering it for PBS. I was in Afghanistan in 2004 as an embedded journalist. And I can tell you from these years of observation and involvement that we need to have a new doctrine that articulates for us the national security policy of the United States. And from that doctrine, we can reshape the United States military. You can't reshape the military without a strategy, without a clearly understood strategy. The third area that we really need to focus on is basic governance. We need to be working toward a governing style that will allow the Congress and the presidency to work together, and also people of different parties to work together. What should you be looking for in terms of leadership? First of all, when I go around the country and I talk to people, I hear over and over again, we need leaders we can trust. We need leaders that will tell us what the problems are, what their beliefs are about the problems, and how they want to fix it. There's a consistency in that. And this kind of leadership requires the willingness to take a risk, to take the hits, to stand up for what you believe, not from a poll that it helps you sort of shape an issue politically or works towards that magic 270 number. And what you need to do is to put out these issues in a way that is not simply smart or safe, but where it is from your heart. And I have to say, the one comment that I've been the proudest of in the leadership positions I've had is when people will tell me, you know something, I don't agree with you all the time, but I know what you say is what you mean. That's not always hard, it's not always easy to do. When I look at the issue of the Iraq War, it was not easy to say early that this was going to be a strategic error. I wrote the first piece in a major national newspaper, the Washington Post, 5 months before the invasion of Iraq. I said, this is going to be a strategic blunder if we go in. It's going to empower Iran. In the long term, it's going to empower China. We're going to have a breakdown in secular violence. And there are ways to address our national security interests without being an occupying force in that part of the world. You know, it's an old saying, you don't take a hornet's nest out by sitting on it. It was not an easy thing to do, to take on criminal justice reform. When I started talking about our broken criminal justice system when I was running for the Senate, I had political advisors telling me, you're committing suicide. In Virginia, second only to Texas in terms of capital punishment and incarceration, But it was so clear that our criminal justice system is broken from point of apprehension to how people are arrested, to prison administration, to how long we sentence them, to the reentry process. We started talking about it. I held 2.5 years of hearings on it when I was in the Senate. We introduced legislation for a national commission. We brought this issue out of the shadows into the national debate. The great irony to me is this is an issue that the Democratic Party should own. Criminal justice reform, social justice. And you know who's making the most mileage out of that issue right now? Rand Paul. Yes. Rand Paul. And when you look at the American Conservative Political Action Conference, it was their number three issue for the Republican Party to be focusing on. We need to get that issue back, the comprehensive issue of criminal justice reform, not simply one little piece of it or another. It was not an easy lift on the GI Bill. You know, when I introduced the GI Bill, my first day in office, I had written it with the committee counsel. I had been a committee counsel in the House before. And the comment that I was making, even before I ran from the Senate, was, you say this is the next greatest generation. Give them the same educational opportunity that the greatest generation had. Pay their tuition. Buy their books. Give them a stipend. And I had people, even Democrats, coming to me and say, you know, you're a freshman. You've been here like 2 weeks. You know, we've got a lot of people who got bills in that we need to get passed in terms of veterans. But this was a comprehensive piece of legislation. We worked hard. We listened to people. We got a lot of support from veterans groups. And we developed a bipartisan consensus, two Republicans, two Democrats, two World War II veterans, two Vietnam veterans, and in 16 months, we were able to pass the most comprehensive piece of veterans legislation since World War II. One of the great prides of my life is that more than a million post-9/11 veterans have now been able to take advantage of our GI Bill. How can we make America a better place? You know, let's look into the future here. I want to say something that troubles me a lot, and I think there are a lot of people in this room who will agree. Money is ruining our political process if we don't get a hold of it. And particularly since the Citizens United case in 2012, this money that's going, I hear Jeb Bush saying he's going to raise $100 million in 3 months. There are these super PACs. He's meeting with the super PACs. He's not alone here, but this cannot continue. The only way we are going to do anything about it is to make sure that our people, by the numbers, can outnumber the kind of money that's coming in here and that we get the policies that we believe into place. That's what we did when I ran for the Senate. We had 14,000 volunteers came up and helped us when we ran against an incumbent senator who had just gotten the highest number of votes for president at the Conservative Political Action Committee. We need to remember that the American dream is a unique thing in this world. You know, when people say you shouldn't talk about American exceptionalism, excuse me, I think the American dream is unique. That's why people are trying to come here from all over the world. I've lived the American dream a little bit. I mean, compared, I was able to get scholarships to go to school. I was able to serve my country. I've had a great experience in my life. But I'll tell you who's really lived the American dream. My wife. You know, my wife Hung was born in Vietnam. Her family escaped Vietnam when the communists took over. Here's something we need to remember. On April the 30th, it's going to be the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And if those of you who can remember what that was like, what the chaos was like in that country, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese were jumping into the sea rather than having to face what was happening when the communists took over. Hung's entire extended family got on a fishing boat, seven siblings, aunts, uncles, et cetera. They went out to sea. They didn't know if they were going to live or die. And after 3 days, and she will be the first to point this out, the United States Navy scooped them out of the sea, brought them to a refugee camp in Guam. From there, she went to a refugee camp in Arkansas, and her family eventually settled in New Orleans. Her parents never spoke English, never mastered the English language. She started working when she was 11, got a scholarship to the University of Michigan, ended up going to Cornell Law School. Now that's the American dream. we're going to preserve this, it's only going to come from the Democratic Party. We have to remember that. We're never going to find an answer in the Republican Party on issues like economic fairness and giving people who have no voice in the corridors of power the voice that the Democratic Party, the party of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, has always given them. And we should say, we should agree, that we are not going to be marginalized by special interests. We are not going to be silenced in the face of overwhelming pressures that this kind of money can buy. We will not acquiesce to a future that marginalizes this whole beauty of the American dream. We will not allow them to ignore us after an election is over. Everyone in this room, I think, shares these kinds of feelings, or you wouldn't be committing yourself to the kind of service that you're giving right now. And if enough of you believe that we can restore and preserve the American dream for everyone, then we will not become what some people are calling the moderate wing of the Republican Party. We will return to the party of Roosevelt and of Truman, the party that truly looks after everyone who lacks a voice in the corridors of power. And Harley Cooper will be proud of me, because we're not going to come in second. We're never going to come in second. We are the finest nation in the world. We're the strongest economic power in the world. We are the guarantor of stability in the world, and that is going to continue. Thank you very much.